This week's podcast is brought to you by West Baton Rouge. Come explore West Baton Rouge this spring and join in for the annual Kite Festival, April 27th through 28th. Visit westbatonrouge.net for more information.
You're listening to Louisiana Insider, a superlative guide to a great state's destinations, hosted by Errol Laborde, executive editor of Louisiana Life magazine.
It's a Louisiana song. My favorite melody is a Louisiana song, hearing it echo through the cypress tree.
If you're in New Orleans and you're driving down Canal Street at the intersection of City Park Avenue where the cemeteries are, you're going to see on one corner something that is literally odd, and it's called Where Odd Fellows Rest, which is a cemetery. I've seen that all my life, and I've always thought, what a strange name to call a cemetery. Even further, there's an organization called Odd Fellows, and that was a traditional burial place for them. And it's an example of the fraternal men's organizations that used to be plentiful in the country, I guess in the world, or as many as they used to be, but they're certainly a part of the history. There's an exhibit at the Historic New Orleans Collection that talks about these kind of organizations. It looks at two in particular, the Freemasons and the Odd Fellows, which are very active in the United States, but there are others too. And we're gonna talk about that. With me is Jaree Honore, who's been the curator of this exhibit, working in partnership with another exhibit in New York. This is Jaree's second time on this show. He was on here previously on an exhibit he curated on early newspapers. And so, which is kind of a thing. He likes genealogy, which is an important topic. He's a certified genealogist, the graduate of St. Augustine Strait School at Tulane University, and he is the family, is that family curator for the Historic New Orleans Collection, is that right?
Family historian.
Family historian, okay. That voice belongs to Dave Walker, former newspaper guy who works for the Historic New Orleans Collection, who helps keep us straight on these kind of things and help him put it together. So plays an important role, and he's urged to jump in to mention anything he wants to as we go on. But Jaree, let's talk about these organizations. There is a history of them, probably an ancient history. I mean, they were active in the United States, and these were efforts to try to create organizations, mostly male organizations, to provide social services for them. Is that correct? Was the Freemasons the first?
Yes, the Freemasons are generally considered the first of the fraternal orders. We have lodge minutes for Masonic lodges going back to the 1590s in Scotland. And from the British Isles, it extends around the globe, including to North America. And in New Orleans, the earliest Masonic lodge we have record of is a lodge called Perfect Harmony or Parfaite Harmonie Lodge, formed in 1752.
Are these organizations religions?
No. In fact, there are no religious requirements to join. All that is required is to be a male of adult age and to profess a belief in a supreme being, however one construes that supreme being. So there are Christian Masons and Odd Fellows, there are Jewish Masons and Odd Fellows, Muslim, as well as those who are deists, like many of our founding fathers.
Now, the term Odd Fellows, it had to have a little bit different meaning in context than we would use it today. Where did they get that term Odd Fellows from originally?
Well, the most most agreed upon story for that title is that these were men who belonged to odd trades, unlike Freemasons who gathered together on what we would call construction sites today. These are men who, say, were hat makers or maybe coopers, where in any town, there would have only been one or two men of those professions. And so not enough to form their own guilds or trade organizations. And so they gathered together from various odd professions. They were fellows of their respective crafts, but odd crafts. The explanation that most members tend to use is that these are men who over time have made themselves odd or conspicuous by their commitment to charity. So one, I think, is a little bit more propaganda, you know, building up the organization. But the other, I think, has some truth to it.
So if someone was a rodeo clown by profession and there was no other one in this town, he'd more likely, maybe there'd be a space for him with the odd fellows.
Sure, absolutely.
Okay. Now, the idea about the Masons, though, going back to Scotland, just goes back to the original, to Egypt and to the original craftsmen who were building things?
That's right. You know, stonemasons were unique individuals in centuries past, because whereas the average farmer may have only traveled in his lifetime maybe 10, 15, 20 miles away from the plot of land that he farmed, or perhaps the farmstead that he worked for others, masons had to travel to their job sites in order to build the cathedrals, the manor houses, the castles, the big building projects in Europe. And so when they would arrive at a site, the first thing they'd have to construct would be a lodge, a mason's lodge, literally a place for them to reside during the years that it would take to work on some of these projects. Think about, say, Notre Dame Cathedral, for example, and how long it took to complete that. And it was in these lodges that over time they would initiate other men into their profession as apprentices, and then fellows of the craft, and then finally as master masons. And so from that tradition, we have speculative Freemason, where we describe those who were actual hands-on masons as operative Freemasons. And of course, most of the members of the craft today are speculative Freemasons.
And the symbols of the Masons were sort of like architectural type symbols?
That's right. The most popular one would be the square and compass, but there's also the plum, the level, and of course the apron of a master mason. All of these are described as the working tools of a mason. And when a lodge is meeting or conducting initiations, degree work, it is said to be at work. So this idea that they very much are working is a trope that has continued in fraternal circles.
And these organizations have developed a good bit of ritual. I mean, they're these very elaborate initiation ceremonies, and I don't know if you call them prayers, but there are things that they read that they hold in common, and they have their own leadership. I mean, so there is structure to these organizations.
Oh, a great deal of structure. The basic unit would be the lodge, the craft lodge, or blue lodge, as it's often called, confers the initial 3 degrees of masonry, that of entered apprentice, a fellow craft, and then master mason. And it is often said that there is no degree higher than that of master mason, but there are additional degrees, sort of variations on a theme, that individuals can undertake that give greater light, greater understanding. And the two best known systems of degrees would be the York Rite and the Scottish Rite. And the Scottish Rite culminates in the 33rd degree. And that's, been the stuff of legend. Many people will recount that they have a father, a grandfather, uncle, or what have you, who was a 33rd degree Mason or 32nd degree Mason.
I remember seeing a book one time, and it was a book of the Scottish Rite rituals. I mean, a very thick book with a lot of rituals in it and a lot of rules to follow.
Yeah, probably the book you're referring to is Morals and Dogma. Morals and Dogma, for a long time, copies were given to each Scottish Rite Mason, is especially in the southern jurisdiction in this country, and recently I think that tradition has been brought back. But it is a very thick book. It's a tome that was written by Albert Pike, People may or may not know that Albert Pike actually has a monument here in New Orleans along Norman Francis Avenue.
Is there like an international headquarters? Is there a head mason somewhere, like a Pope of the Masons somewhere?
No, it is very much diffused in its organizational structure. In this country, each state Grand Lodge is sovereign. And so there is no one above, say, the Grand Master of Masons in any particular state or territory. Most of the lodges in this country trace their origin back to the Grand Lodge of England, but even that body only has supervision over the lodges, you know, in England and in possessions or former possessions of Great Britain. There is a Grand Lodge of France. There is a Grand Lodge in Italy. So there is no worldwide overarching structure for Freemasonry.
So do organizations like the Odd Fellows, do they operate pretty much in the same way?
Pretty much in the same way. The terminology used is often the same or very similar. Odd Fellows meet in lodges. Members of the Elks meet in lodges. Members of the Woodmen of the World meet in camps or lodges. All of these organizations are very similar.
So that model is fairly common in terms of pattern after the Masons. We've learned that many, if not all, of the founding fathers of the country were Masons, that there was a huge Mason influence, including George Washington. I think there's a painting of him showing where one of those Mason aprons. And some people pointed out that there are a lot of symbols that people didn't realize in Washington, D.C., that the Masonic symbols, including the street pattern, that the street pattern in Washington is laid out in a Masonic sort of way. Are you familiar with that?
That's often been expressed. We have nothing that points to a clear Masonic link in terms of the layout of Washington, D.C. But we, as you said, Masons are present from the very beginning. George Washington lays the cornerstone of the U.S. Capitol building in a Masonic ceremony. The painting that you're talking about of Washington in lodge with his apron is actually reproduced in our exhibit, Mystery and Benevolence. And I think that about 13 or 14 American presidents thus far have been Freemasons, along with Benjamin Franklin and so many of the founding fathers.
So in the earlier days, then the purpose of the Masons, when I guess it provided unity, it probably provided to some people some kind of business advantage and political advantage. I mean, just to be lumped together with a bunch of guys that had prestige, I'm sure that crossed their mind as well. But there was always the benevolence aspect of them too. You know, at a time when you didn't have a lot of insurance programs or social aid programs, that this provided a device to provide that. What, medical help and burial help? Is that what something that they were doing?
Absolutely. These types of organizations formed that safety net for individuals before a lot of government programs were created or before commercial insurance was widely available. They provided, you know, prescription benefits and doctor's care and a proper burial place. At times when individuals oftentimes couldn't afford these things, and provided for the widows and children of their members. And it helps to explain why these groups were just so ubiquitous. We have estimates that at the turn of the 20th century, anywhere between 20 to 40% of American men belong to at least one fraternal organization. I mean, they were so popular that if you look at some of our incredibly popular TV programs, The Honeymooners. You know, they belong to the Raccoon Lodge, and Amos and Andy, they belong to the Mystic Knights of the Sea, even the Flintstones. Fred and Barney belong to a fraternal lodge. So it was a part of American life. Maybe not so much today, but I think they still have a role to play in helping to form civic life, bring people together in a setting that is not overtly religious, that is not overtly political, but where they have a common goal and objective.
I remember the Honeymooners, Ralph Cramden, who didn't have a lot of discipline in his life, but he did with this organization. And I mean, he took it seriously. And they, when there were rituals, they wore raccoon hats, and they had some kind of a greeting they did where they shake the tail on the raccoon's tail on their cap. And so the wives thought it was ridiculous, as I recall. But yeah, those are important in their lives. Would they be there's a building in New Orleans, the Pythian Hall, and that's the name, the Knights of Pythias. Now, from what I know, that the Knights of Pythias, it was originally a white organization, as most of them were, but at some point in the United States, they developed into two. There was the, for lack of a better term, the Black Knights of Pythias and the White Knights of Pythias. And what we have in New Orleans, that building we'll see on Loyola Avenue, would be from the Black Knights of Pythias. I think New Orleans was like really the epicenter in starting that particular movement.
You're absolutely right. Like just about every aspect of American life, even fraternalism, which of course in and of itself is built on brotherhood, it was segregated. And so Freemasonry throughout its history has been divided between what we call mainstream, or for lack of a better word, white Freemasonry, and then the Prince Hall tradition. And yes, the Knights of Pythias was started in 1864 during the Civil War, got early praise from President Lincoln. And then in 1880, the Colored Knights of Pythias was started, and the temple building on Loyola Avenue here was built in 1908 by the Grand Lodge of Black Knights of Pythias here in Louisiana. And it's a beautiful building, a very impressive building when you think that it was built in 1908, not even, you know, 50 years after the end of slavery. And it was best known for its roof garden, which was a music venue, dance venue, at the very top of the building, where the men saw the minstrel show that inspired them to form the Zulu organization, where some of the early proms for schools like McDonough 35 were held, many different mass meetings. Roland Hayes, the operatic tenor, performed there. Armand Piron was the band leader there for quite a while. So it's a very important building that housed not only the lodge functions, but bookstores, insurance companies, all sorts of African-American businesses.
And I believe, when I remember, that the man who started I think he was at the, whatever they call him, the chief of the Louisiana Black Knights of Pythias. Wasn't he like one of the wealthiest men in the country? And he put a lot of his money into this project.
That's right. You're talking about Smith Wendell Green. He went by S.W. Green. He was Grand Chancellor of the Knights of Pythias in Louisiana, and he was Supreme Chancellor of the Knights of Pythias in the U.S. and internationally. And he was, worth, well over $1 million due to some of his business acumen, but in large part because of the success of the Knights of Pythias. It's almost hard to believe how successful these organizations were, to the point where they had resort facilities for their members in Hot Springs, Arkansas, hospitals, newspapers of their own. They were able to, in many instances, charter railroad cars or buses for their members, so that they didn't have to take advantage of the segregated accommodations that they otherwise would have been limited to in decades past. So they were incredibly successful.
Now, a lot of these organizations are not very active anymore. I mean, their time has passed. If they're an active 50th organization, for example, or are the Masons that active?
The Masons are still quite active. The Grand Lodge of Louisiana, the mainstream Grand Lodge of Louisiana, has a very prominent campus there in Alexandria, Louisiana. They used to be housed in what is the Hilton Hotel building down on St. Charles Avenue, but since the 80s or so, they've been out in Alexandria. And the Prince Hall Grand Lodge of Louisiana has its headquarters in Baton Rouge, so very much still active. The mainstream Knights of Pythias and the historically Black Knights of Pythias, they both still exist in multiple states, but the Black Knights of Pythias don't have any lodges in Louisiana at present.
And some of these buildings were really beautiful on the inside, and they had, there was a Knights of Columbus Lodge, I think on Camp Street or one of those inner streets downtown, and it was a tall building. It wasn't a small lodge, and it had a theater on top, and just a really nice theater. I mean, it was a good performance space, I guess, just in the same way that the Knights of Pythias had theirs, you know, on the roof. So they seem to be interested in production and theater. And I think it's a great story, though, about the Knights of Pythias having this roof garden where you had performances and you had people performing there who were really part of the early roots of jazz. And so there was sort of a connection then between the Knights of Pythias, I mean, providing that space and a good place to go to, and some of these people, like you mentioned, Norman Piron performing. The guys who started Zulu saw this burlesque performed there, which they, about a mythical king named Zulu, and they got the idea to do it. So that building had a lot of influence.
Absolutely. And, you know, throughout the business district, downtown New Orleans, we have the old Scottish Rite Temple on Carondelet Street.
That's what I'm thinking about, yeah.
Yeah, there's the Eagle Saloon, which is, you know, a sacred site in early jazz history. Its top floor, and there used to be a connected building adjacent to it, was leased for many years by the Black Oddfellows and Masons. It was called Masonic and Oddfellows Hall. There is also the home of New Orleans Lodge number 30 of the BPOE, the Benevolent and Protective Order of Elks, or as they often say, the best people on earth, on Elk Place. And folks, you know, who've lived here all their lives never stop and think that Elk Place is named that because it was home to the local Lodge of Elks. And that building is now Tulane Social Work School.
You know, these organizations had a big influence also in the evolution of Carnival. The town of Mobile refers to itself as the mother of mystics. And I think I'll just discuss that a lot of those organizations that evolved there. Mobile was sort of like a melting pot in the South where a lot of people pass through of different cultures. But anyway, some of these mythical organizations inspired the structure, at least, of the organizations that became the early Carnival organizations in Mobile. And they, which in turn influenced the ones in New Orleans. So if you look at the early Carnival organizations in New Orleans, like Momus and Comus and Proteus, they had that sort of structure. I mean, their mission was different. I mean, they weren't providing burial insurance, but that kind of Masonic structure was very influential.
Absolutely. You know, we have to remember that these organizations come about in an era long before television, long before radio, and other, you know, forms of home amusement. And so the theatrical side was very important. And ultimately, what is Carnival? What are the beautiful tableaus that the groups put on other than theater? And the ritualistic work of these fraternal orders is very much theater, the ability to convey the ritualized text, the costumes, the choreography, move left, move right, stand, sit. All of this very much was sort of a layman's attempt to get in at theater and at elocution. So that, I think that aspect belongs to both Carnival as well as to fraternalism.
And there's one of the cemeteries around where Oddfellows is. Is it Greenwood? Is there a cemetery by that name? But one of them, okay. if you look kind of in the middle, they have a really towering sort of tomb for someone. And I'm sorry, I forget the guy's name, but he was one of these guys who came from Mobile and who was involved in forming Mardi Gras and forming Rex. And in fact, he was, in starting Comus. And if you read the inscriptions, he was the Grand Master of the Louisiana Masonic Lodge. So back then, okay, this had been in the 1850s. So here was the guy who was the Grand Master at the Louisiana Masonic Lodge, also being instrumental in starting Comus. And so you see that kind of influence, that same type of structure there. I think that monument's pretty important in New Orleans history. Nobody knows about it because you can understand something about what's going on. But that influence was definitely there.
Absolutely. When you think about Greenwood itself, Greenwood was founded by and is still owned by, the Firemen's, charitable benevolent relief association. And a lot of people aren't aware that that is the corporate name, for the owner of that cemetery. And it just goes to show you that even amongst different professions, one of the things that the employees would do would be to form benevolent organizations. We think about the Fraternal Order of Police and how it provides for its members, especially those who fall in the line of duty. It's just an extension of what we see with the Masons and Oddfellows and the other organizations.
And even like Zulu, Zulu's full name, it calls itself the Zulu Social Aid and Pleasure Society. And so by the social aid, they're talking about the kind of things we're talking about providing the burial insurance and the medical help when needed. They're also good with the pleasure part too. But there's an island in the Caribbean. It's one of the off islands, one of the French islands. I think maybe Les Saintes. Anyway, they have a big celebration for the feast day of St. Lawrence. And St. Lawrence... the legend is that he was it's kind of a growth legend. He fell into a pot of boiling oil and was killed. But anyway, but he's kind of remembered as the patron saint of chefs. And they celebrate on his feast day. And this is a women's organization to celebrate it's Black women who celebrate the Feast of St. Lawrence. And what they do with it, they have this big, big lunch of all kind of native things. And of course they sell tickets and people go. And that's the thing you do on the island on that day. You go to the Feast of St. Lawrence, have a parade with a statue of St. Lawrence. And that's what they're doing, is that they're raising money for burials. It's that same sort of spirit. It's not like a fraternal organization, obviously, but it's this social aid idea. And so there's the social aid idea in different ways and different structures, you see as being pervasive. And for the same reason, they're not as necessary anymore because there's more government and and private health.
We have the same thing here in New Orleans in all of our older cemeteries, be they religious or secular. You find these large tombs, society tombs, with groups with all of these exotic names or flowery names, the Young Ladies of Providence, the Young Men of Liberty, the Benevolent Daughters of Louisiana, and all of these groups built tombs so that their members would have appropriate resting places in a city where land is at a premium, burial space is at a premium, and so everybody can't have their own individual burial plot or family tomb, but they have these collective tombs where members are buried. And like I said, they dot the landscapes in all of our cemeteries.
Yeah. And going back to the foot of Canal by the cemeteries, you see that magnificent one with the elk on top. It's a big burial place, and you see another one with a farm. And I think it's that kind of thing that people get together and collectively. I don't know if they're still populated, for lack of a better word, anymore, but they're beautiful to see.
The usage of them has gone down tremendously because, again, most people, go to cremation or they have their burials are otherwise provided for by their families. But I can tell you that every year there are still memorial services conducted by the local Elks Lodge at that grave site. And The same goes for the Masons and other fraternal organizations. An interesting story is that it was only in 2020 that Michael Duplantier and Emily Ford, Eddie LaBeouf, and others resurrected the Independent Order of Odd Fellows here in New Orleans, if for no other reason, to take legal ownership of Odd Fellows Rest. These people are all history-minded, they're preservationists, and they wanted to have some work done at Odd Fellows Rest, but they ran into a stumbling block, which is they were not the legal owners. And contractors were not willing to do work if they didn't have ownership of the cemetery, and so they revived the Odd Fellows in Louisiana, and it's continued to grow. There is maybe a future for Odd Fellowship in New Orleans. The Odd Fellows Hall was located on Camp Street in the area where the federal court building is now, and it was condemned in 1914 for an interesting reason. It was a hotbed. It was tied to the bubonic plague. Some of the men who were employed there as caretakers and their families came down with the plague, and there were several fatalities. And finally, the federal government condemned the place and had it razed. So that's how the Odd Fellows building met its end in New Orleans.
That's amazing. Does the Odd Fellows function at all? I mean, is it possible? Could somebody go and join up and say, I want to be an Odd Fellow? Or is it just a legal entity?
No. They are a fully functioning lodge. The mainstream Odd Fellows, i.e., you know, the formerly whites only Odd Fellows, of course, they integrated now. They went co-ed a few decades ago, and so now men and women can actually join the Odd Fellows Lodge. In years past, women would join the Rebeccas, which was the female counterpart to the Odd Fellows. But the Rebeccas have sort of gone by the wayside. They still exist, but they're very small because women can now join the Odd Fellows Lodge.
Yeah. It reminds me more about the marching group, the ruling Elvi. These guys dressed like Elvis on the scooter, and their wives and girlfriends said, hey, we want to be in this too. So they started a group called the Priscillas. And so they have a truck that the Priscillas ride behind. And now they're letting the Priscillas being Elvi too. And so I know someone who graduated from being a Priscilla to being an Elvi. What a fascinating history. It's a story that needs to be told. I mean, there's just so much to all of this. I remember I was asking at the very beginning if this was a religion. It seems like I remember hearing at one time that the Catholic Church kind of frowned on these kind of things because they were kind of concerned who they were worshiping. But then ultimately, the Catholic Church all of a sudden came to Knights of Columbus, I mean, which is like a Catholic organization. And so you have your own Catholic variation of it too, which is very much of an active organization.
Sure. And that's why in 1882, Father Michael McGivney up in Connecticut formed the Knights of Columbus, was to have fraternal benefits, have the strength of a fraternal order available to men who were practicing Catholics, so that they wouldn't join the Masons or the Odd Fellows or other groups that were considered banned societies by the church, and actually still are. In fact, just a few months ago, the Holy See sort of doubled down and reiterated that at least from its standpoint, Catholics are not to be Masons. Now, that prohibition has never been there from Freemasonry, but from the Catholic side itself, they're not supposed to be Masons. And then in this country, 1894, I believe it was, there was a prohibition against the Odd Fellows, the Knights of Pythias, the Sons of Temperance, as well. But the Knights of Columbus are now an international order. And then in 1909, over in Mobile, the Knights of Peter Claver was started as a Catholic fraternal order for African-American men and women. And ever since the 1940s, their headquarters has been, international headquarters, has been right here in New Orleans. Starting in the 50s, they acquired the old French hospital on Orleans Avenue, and they're still there, but the French hospital was torn down decades ago. And it was a real long.
They're right in the heart of Treme. I mean, you talk about the classic Black Creole culture. I mean, the Church of Peter Claver. It may be on the endangered list. I'm not sure if it's still open right now, but I mean, the building is still there. It'd be nice if these places would survive. So, and again, they're great buildings, and if something could go on with them too. You know, that's the problem that you see, and you see all these old churches and things that are being closed, and they were great buildings when they were built. And first people said, well, we'll make them into a community center, but you don't need that many community centers. You know what I mean? And they said, well, we'll make them into theaters. Well, they don't always convert really easy to theaters. And so, but I wish there's some kind of way that they could exist, if nothing is more than a place to go and sit down and just kind of find themselves and meditate or do something. But there's a great experience. Let me call on Dave with the Historic New Orleans Collection. First of all, have we gotten everything right? Are we all okay?
So far, so good. You're in really good hands with Jari. He knows this topic field so well.
Yeah, I'll say I'm very impressive. I want to get back to Jari in a second, but also before we started this, you were mentioning about a really interesting exhibit that's coming up with the collection.
Yeah, we have a new exhibit that just opened. So we've got a full house. We've got both of the fraternal organization exhibits that are on view until May 10th. And then just last week, we have a new exhibition open called Unknown Sitters. And it's a collection of paintings or portraits from our collection where the identity of the subject is unknown. And there are several interactive elements in the exhibit where we encourage visitors to imagine who these subjects are.
And do you all
And
know who they are? Do you know, or is it just
no,
a
we don't. We
oh, no.
don't. And that identity is lost through time for many different reasons. We have actually more than 100 of these works in our collection. There are 26 in the exhibit. And we thought it was like a fun prompt for visitors to kind of tap their imaginations. We know about mostly who all the painters were, all the artists. We know the time frame, we know the setting, and visitors get to imagine who the subjects were. Our annual student writing contest used this as a prompt this year, where the students had three paintings to choose from, all the way, I think, third grade through high school. And we received more than 1,000 entries from every state in the country and the District of Columbia. The winning entries are in the exhibit. So that's another great connection to imagination. And that's on view until early October. It's really been a lot of fun, and the interactives include drawing, is sort of examining the art of portraiture from both the subject and artist's perspective. So you can draw, have a mirror and draw your own portrait. You can imagine there are several like postcard style things there where you can write down who you think these people were. And so that's a really fun new thing that's just now on view.
What a great thing to do, just to pick a miscellaneous character and develop a whole history for him, you know. Oh,
And some of the student contributions are hilarious. Some of them are cute. Some are really poignant and deeply serious. Our curator has said, Lydia Blackmore has said, that you could sort of tell what the students were studying at the time that they were thinking about these things because they incorporate history that they've learned. It's really the winning entries are all on our website, hnoc.org. And I encourage people to go and read them because they're fascinating. Third grade to high school, it's really one of the coolest sort of tie-ins to an exhibition that we've done.
I always thought that'd be interesting, like go to a place like the Chalmette Battlefield and walk around and just pick out a name on a tomb and develop a story for the person, with the understanding that's a developed story. It's not the real story, but okay. But just, you know, from what you know about the person, when he died and, you know, where was, who knows, he might have been from Scotland and was part of the Scottish Rite bases over there, okay. But just to kind of develop and kind of put some soul in them, I think it's an interesting project.
Yeah, I also wanted to briefly mention, coming up May 9th, we've got a public program tied to the fraternal organization exhibits. And this is the New Orleans premiere of a documentary called Join or Die. And some years ago, there was a book called Bowling Alone. And it was all an examination of the decline of sort of third place organizations, you know, homework, and then the bowling leagues and fraternal organizations and how they've declined in American life. And this documentary looks at all of that. And that's the main attraction. But we've also invited lots of different community groups to set up tables and tell attendees about the benefits of fraternal organizations or bowling leagues or organizations outside the home and work of all kinds. And that's May 9th, and that's going to be a really interesting evening, I think.
Wow. I was talking to somebody who was, or somebody I know was talking to somebody who's in the Tour Guide Association, and she was complaining that they can't get young tour guides interested in the Tour Guide Association anymore. You know, I just don't know why, but there's so much to learn, okay? Anyway, that's really interesting, Dave. And Jari, what's next for you? What's your next big project?
Well, as Dave said, we still have about 3 or 4 more weeks of that these two exhibits will be with us. And then in the fall, at some point, we will have a continuation of our public programming that deals with family history here at the collection. It'll probably take the form of an archival show and tell, where we'll pull some of our holdings that have genealogical value and invite our members and the general public to come and have a look.
Okay, let me mention, this is on our website, so some people could be hearing this long after the exhibit is closed, but if someone wants access to it, how can they get it?
All of the, everything you need about planning a visit or all the programs we do, or Jari's work, all is at hnoc.org, which is our website.
Thanks, y'all. This has been really interesting.
Thank you.
Thank you, Errol. It's always a pleasure. Again.
Okay, bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to Louisiana Insider. Subscribe, like, and rate our show where you listen to your podcasts, and follow us on social media at Louisiana Life Mag. Executive producer for Louisiana Insider is Kelly Massico, in cooperation with Louisiana Life Magazine. For subscription information to Louisiana Life, call 504-828-1380. Our theme music was provided by Rich Collins. Hey, that's me. Join us again next week for more discoveries inside Louisiana.